From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Much has been made of the immigration crisis in the U.S. and how detention centers have morphed into concentration camps as record numbers of people migrate northward and as Donald Trump's administration insists on locking up all the fleeing refugees. But less attention is paid to why people are risking the dangerous journey and the ordeal that awaits them in the U.S. Even less is paid to those who are deported back across the border into Mexico. Now, a new book examines that under-examined aspect of the immigration crisis. It's written by Jeremy Slack, Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Texas in El Paso. He's the editor of The Shadow of the Wall, Violence and Migration on the U.S.-Mexico Border. And his newest book is called Deported to Death, How Drug Violence is Changing Migration on the U.S.-Mexico Border. Welcome to the program, Jeremy.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So when you say, when we talk about those who are deported back into Mexico by the U.S., they're not just Mexicans, right? The U.S. government has essentially, pushed Central Americans, and in the Trump administration's anti-immigrant efforts has arranged for Mexico to hold Central American migrants seeking asylum in Mexico while their cases are being processed. So it's basically a mix of refugees that have been deported?
That's correct. I mean, this is a new policy, basically beginning in around 2019, when in addition to Mexicans being returned to Mexico, they started to return Central Americans as well. Which creates a whole nother host of issues, right? I mean, typically it's illegal to remove someone to a third country. And so what we're seeing is a lot of changes to how the basic functioning of asylum law, and immigration in general function.
So how far back does your book examine what the situation is on the other side of the border when people are deported? Because this crisis, of course, is decades old.
Yes, that's correct. The book really starts when I began doing field work on this issue in about 2007. A group of friends in graduate school, we decided to get together and do a research project on people that had recently been removed to Mexico, conducting surveys about their experiences with U.S. authorities, you know, issues in detention that we're still seeing brought up today. But at that same time was also when we started to see this explosion in drug-related violence, an increase in kidnapping, an increase in people being extorted or threatened or forced to carry drugs across the border. And so this became my personal issue to pursue over about the next 8 or 9 years of research, where I essentially traveled up and down the border, living and working in several different migrant shelters to see the ways in which people interact with the violence that's all around them after being dropped off in these border towns, often with very little resources, almost no knowledge of this area of Mexico, and frankly being preyed upon because they're seen as a good source of revenue. They have ties to the United States. They can pay ransom. And this extremely vulnerable population is often ignored even today.
So these are people who have spent some significant time in the U.S. and then were deported?
Yes, that's correct. The average amount of time was about 8 years in the United States. I mean, we found that, you know, when we did our survey, about a third of the people that have been deported considered the United States their home. And so those group of people are, you know, they've switched from being at home in Mexico to the United States and are going to cross back despite the cost, despite the danger, despite the threats of being locked up, right? So this is a group that is very much stuck at the border trying to figure out a way to get back. And the other thing with this group of people is they often don't have any contacts left in Mexico. They might not know people. Some people that came when they're very young don't even exist on paper in Mexico anymore and are left at the border trying to navigate this very complicated and dangerous world without really having any resources to do that.
So a lot of stories are told about the violence preying or the violence that migrants are face when they travel through Mexico to the U.S. But those who have spent time in the U.S., deported back and end up in a part of, you know, Mexico. Mexico is a huge country. To end up in a part of a country that they have very little familiarity with, they have to either begin rebuilding their lives and or begin planning to return to the U.S. Where they feel their homes still are. So do you find that there's a big difference between those who end up in rural parts of the country versus urban parts of the country?
Yes, there certainly is a big difference in terms of what their skills are, what they know, who they have contacts with. You know, I think one of the big issues that I want to stress here is, you know, people think of deportation as I'm sending you back home, but that's not really what's happening, right? As you mentioned, Mexico is a huge country. Often people are, you know, deported thousands of miles away from where they are from. It's as if someone from the United States was deported to dropped off in Detroit when they're from Southern California, right? This is not the same place. These are not the same groups of people, and finding out how to navigate that. You might not have identification. You probably can't receive a money transfer. And combine that with high levels of violence makes it extremely difficult.
Can you share some stories with some of the people that you interacted with, and how the issue of drug violence in particular has impacted them? The Trump administration and Republicans and conservatives have given the impression to the American people that drugs are pouring across the border, and that those who come into the U.S. across the border are smuggling them in, are nefarious, are violent, and are destroying American society. Put that into a broader context. Give us more nuance of how exactly drug violence counteracts with the migration crisis, using actual examples of real people.
Sure. I mean, I think there's a couple myths that are worth dispelling right away, right? The majority of the people that are apprehended trafficking drugs into the United States are U.S. citizens, right? Drugs come through ports of entry. It's easiest to move drugs when you combine the enormous task of sifting through thousands and thousands of tons of legal goods, thousands and thousands of people crossing legally every day. Small packages of drugs hidden within those vehicles is the easiest way to do it. I did a lot of work interviewing people that smuggle backpacks of marijuana across the border. And what we found is a lot of these people are really agricultural workers, or sometimes sporadically employed urban workers in the northern border area. And they don't have any intention of staying in the United States in the large part, right? In order to get paid, they have to go back to Mexico. And so often what you see is people doing this enormous task, walking with a backpack that's extremely heavy for usually 5 to 7 days in the desert, in the heat, and almost dying. And one man who told me about his story, you know, he explained that he thought he was going to go work in the fields, and he showed up and they had a truck full of marijuana bales, and they said, "You're carrying this today?" And he knew that if he said no, he would be in trouble. So he said yes, walked for days and days, gets to the United States, immediately driven and dropped back at the border. He goes back and they don't want to pay him. They told him he has to take another load across, right? And so what we see is a lot of people that are really just simply agricultural workers, farm workers, get caught up in these cycles, and they don't have anything to do with these bigger issues. Now, I'll also stress that the vast majority don't have any experience with drugs as well.
It's amazing that you point out that the majority of people that are bringing drugs into the country are U.S. citizens. That's certainly not a fact that is popular with those, you know, pushing anti-immigrant sentiment here in the United States. So what about Mexico's position on all of this, the Mexican government's position on all of this? Now, you said your research goes back, you know, about 10 years or so, but we have a new government in Mexico right now. Andrés Manuel López Obrador's left-leaning or center-left government is, you know, was supposed to be more compassionate towards migrants. Looks like it's capitulating to U.S. pressure. And he was also supposed to take a strong stand on the issue of drugs and drug-related violence. Has anything happened? Has the landscape at all changed since you started doing your research?
I mean, it's certainly been a disappointing start to the López Obrador presidency. He did ride this very populist wave, this idea that he was going to fight corruption, that he was going to, instead of focus the government's efforts at fighting drug traffickers by attacking the powerful drug bosses, he was going to do something to actually protect people on the ground, right? Neither of those seem to have really materialized. And he has capitulated to Donald Trump with some very, very heavy-handed and brutal policies, particularly the idea of letting the United States deport people from Central America to Mexico's northern border cities to wait, right? This is essentially like taking all the issues I discuss in my book and throwing napalm on it. People are in extremely precarious situations. I'm currently doing some research with them in both Juarez and Tijuana, living in conditions that are very dangerous, being preyed upon, being extorted, no access to work, a lot of discrimination. A lot of people don't want to hire Central Americans. And it's creating a lot of pressure and also hatred against people to make sure that these individuals get either arrested, sometimes scooped up by drug trafficking organizations. It's becoming extremely violent again. And unfortunately, it doesn't seem like López Obrador has any plans to really address the situation for people that live at the border, which is really the most important issue.
Do you find that the role of the migration and the drug violence intersection has changed with the slow state-by-state legalization of marijuana in the United States?
Certainly, yes. We still do see some trafficking of marijuana across the border, but very limited. You know, we're actually seeing multiple cases of people being arrested bringing marijuana from the United States to Mexico now, because it's better quality and has, you know, different options. Mexico has increased their consumption of drugs over the last decade as well. But you see a lot of drug cartels shifting their production, right? A lot of emphasis on synthetic drugs, so methamphetamines, other pills. This is usually often done in places like Michoacán, where the port cities are extremely important for bringing chemicals from China. But we also see increased production of heroin, refining of heroin, whereas Mexico was traditionally only creating kind of black tar, which is a very low refined form of heroin. They're now producing China White, trying to diversify, trying to provide the U.S. consumers with the drugs that they want.
In the just going back to what your book covered, in those border regions where deported migrants from the U.S. are preyed upon by the drug cartels, who is most vulnerable? I imagine young men are a strong target, but I imagine that women are also preyed upon.
Yes, both. I think that there's probably a slightly different style in the ways that people are preyed upon. Women are certainly extremely vulnerable, but especially when we talk about Mexican undocumented migration, right? This is very different from people seeking asylum. It's still largely male, right? We're talking about 85 to 90% young men who come here for work reasons. And so there is a huge focus on recruiting young men or work in drug trafficking. One of the things that I noticed with kidnapping is that ransoms are often demanded. Sometimes they're paid, sometimes they're not, but it doesn't seem to correlate very well to being released. And one of the things that I saw a lot in the interviews I did with victims of kidnapping is that they would be tortured and given the option of, joining the cartel. If they were willing to kill one of the other people that's captured, that would be enough to prove that they work with the cartel. And doing so means that they can't really return to their day-to-day lives. One of the people I interviewed said that the other people that were with him would put on the masks and just disappear into the ranks of the kidnappers. It's a very scary thought and a very difficult problem to solve when you see so much coercion to convince people to do bad things under the threat of death themselves.
So in terms of the drug cartels and how they have operated on the border, what about the role of police? Did you find that those deportees who were preyed upon by the cartels were also traumatized by the police, or was there any recourse with law enforcement?
Yes. You know, I ran into some horrific situations while doing this research. You know, a member of the police was involved in kidnapping and raping women at the border who had been removed. We saw, especially in places like Tijuana, an extreme focus on extorting migrants and deportees. They would basically know where people were coming from. If they were coming home from work, if they're all dirty, is the time to pick somebody up and take their money, and usually send them to jail for 36 hours if they don't have identification. In other places, we saw police more directly involved with kidnapping and torture. Often what we would find is that people get deported in random spots along the border. And if you happen to be deported to Mexico in a state that is at war with a drug cartel from your state, you're in extreme amounts of danger. And so, for example, in Tamaulipas in northeastern Mexico, people from Michoacan would get abducted by the police and tortured to give up information if they were working for drug cartels in their home state, right? This became commonplace, and we would see people brutally beaten for being from these cartel hotspots around Mexico, with the assumption that anyone from those places is working for a rival, and the police were almost always involved with this.
Wow. So when you did your research and you saw all of these various forces collide, what can you tell us, and you write about this, what can you tell us about this precarious position that these vulnerable deportees find themselves in? You describe, you know, mobility as violence, this idea that they're having to cross back and forth as in and of itself akin to a death sentence. What is the impact on them?
Well, this idea comes from the fact that who you are in relationship to the border changes the way you're going to be treated. Mm-hmm. So people that are engaged in crossing the border, people that have been deported, people that are, you know, at the moment waiting in Mexico, either for the chance to cross the border or waiting after for their court appearances. People are aware of this, right? People know who this is. And these are people that are in limbo. And it creates a certain type of vulnerability that's extremely difficult for people to realize, because these aren't people that are either at their homes, they're not at their destination, they're in this interstitial space, they're in this limbo where people often don't know how to get in touch with them, people don't know where they are, they often have trouble getting in touch with their loved ones, and it makes them extremely easy to prey upon, right? They can disappear and nobody will miss them for months and maybe even years.
So finally, in the last few minutes of our conversation, I'm wondering what you think needs to change about our approach to migration, the flow of drugs. Many people have talked about many solutions over the years, including drug legalization or, making our borders more open and treating migrants less punitively. Having done this research for many years and seeing firsthand the personal impact on vulnerable human beings, what do you recommend needs to happen?
Well, I think that the biggest issue is that there are really no legal options available for migration. And as we see more and more people who have, you know, put down roots in the United States, who have children here, who have a life in the United States, we need to have some ways for them to come legally. This would take a lot of the pressure off. And for anyone who's concerned about security, about violent criminals, this would also make it easier for any law enforcement agency to find people who have criminal records, right? If there were actually a legitimate way for the vast majority of people to come who have never been in trouble, who just come and work hard and raise their families, then it would make it easier to find people dangerous, right? And I think one of the issues we're facing with the increase in asylum right now is that this is a very inefficient system. It's a very difficult system. It's a very hard system. If there were actually a way for people to migrate, to come and work, even if it's just a temporary work visa, this would take a lot of that pressure off. And I think that's the first step to figuring out how to solve the problems of the border. Certainly, one of the issues is that a lot of the policies for border enforcement have made the situation worse. And this includes sending people to federal prison for crossing the border so that they're now labeled as felons just for crossing the border, something that we didn't used to do, as well as shuffling people from one border city to another, sending people to random places, separating families. This all makes it more difficult for people to protect themselves.
Right. I mean, basically treating human beings like they're just objects. And the Trump administration has made an art out of how to treat migrants in the worst possible way. Even the threats of immigration raids against those who have received deportation orders but who haven't abided by them. The sending of notices of fines of hundreds of thousands of dollars for people who've received deportation orders. It's just quite remarkable. Unfortunately. It seems as though we would have to wait for a new president in order for anything humane to actually come about, right? I mean, we're dealing with a mind as diabolical as Trump's and of course, Stephen Miller's. So I'm assuming that you're not holding out hope for at least, till the 2020 election?
Yes, and I think that's going to be an uphill battle at that moment as well. Now, I would say that there's been a lot of resistance. There's been amazing work going on at the border in terms of lawyers, in terms of activists, in terms of advocates, researchers, trying to compile information and to do the long, hard fight, which is essentially to try and win these asylum claims. This is something that's notoriously difficult to do, but because of the effort, because of the amount of heroic work that's being done on the border to protect people, we do see people being able to protect themselves, being able to get to the United States, to reunite with family, to get relief, to win asylum claims. And so I think that's something that we should all look to and understand that people are working really hard to improve people's lives while these inhumane policies continue.
Well, Jeremy, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and for discussing your book with us. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Jeremy Slack, Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Texas in El Paso and editor of The Shadow of the Wall, Violence and Migration on the U.S.-Mexico Border. We've been discussing his new book, Deported to Death, How Drug Violence is Changing Migration on the U.S.-Mexico Border. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.